Argentina's power grid collapsed Sunday morning, plunging the entire country into a massive blackout. In Buenos Aires, streetlights, shops, and subways all cut off from power. The outage spilled across borders into Uruguay and Paraguay, leaving tens of millions of people without electricity. Argentine President Mauricio Macri called the blackout unprecedented and promised a thorough investigation.
This seaplane could soon be powered by electricity. Vancouver-based Harbor Air Seaplanes is working with U.S. electric engine maker Magni X to build the world's first electric-powered commercial airline. Its 40-strong fleet flies 500,000 people a year across 12 routes. And with the aviation industry accounting for 2% of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide, their goal is to make flights kinder to the environment.
Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam has apologized to the public as swarms of people dressed in black marched through the city on Sunday, protesting her controversial extradition bill and calling for her to step down. Lam indefinitely delayed the bill on Saturday in a dramatic retreat, but it wasn't enough to stop this sea of black descending onto the streets. It was a different story earlier this week when demonstrators were met with tear gas and rubber bullets from Hong Kong police.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's June the 17th. It's 5:10 in the morning. And thank you for joining us for another edition of The Opening Bell. Here we go. We're getting underway with a business week, another business day. And we've put together a really good broadcast to start it all off for you this morning. Mark Hamrick will be up first this morning from Bankrate.com. Mark is one of the senior economic analysts at Bankrate. We're going to be talking a little bit about the economy and the recovery from the recession from 2008 and on. A new survey says many people still haven't recovered from that financially. Mark will be here in just a few minutes. A little bit later in the program, Jonathan Mays, our friend at Restaurant Magazine, will be here. Jonathan is the executive editor there. There is a new push for meat-free burgers. The product may be coming to the Golden Arches as well. We'll join Jonathan at about 5:38 this morning for a conversation about that. We'll also keep you posted on the latest news, weather, sports, traffic, and more as we head through this hour. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell rings for the first time this week after the Dow Jones Industrials ended slightly lower on Friday. At the closing bell, the Dow was down about 17 points. The Nasdaq was off about 40. The S&P lost about 5 points. This morning, markets look like they might be positive at the opening bell, with the Dow, Nasdaq, S&P futures up about a quarter of a percent each. As we look around the rest of the world, in London, France, and Germany, markets are higher by about a quarter of a percent. In Asia, markets also generally in the green, with markets in Hong Kong up nearly a half a percent. Everything else is up just about a quarter of a percent. And in oil, let's see, $52.19 a barrel is what New York is showing, down about 32 cents. We have a few headlines as we begin the podcast this morning. Workers at Volkswagen's only U.S. factory won't be joining a union. Hourly workers at the plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, narrowly turned down an organizing effort by the United Auto Workers Union. 48% of hourly staff at the plant voted in favor of joining the union. The vote was a little closer than the organizing effort 5 years ago, but still short of the majority required to unionize at the plant, where about 1,600 workers voted. The Chattanooga plant is the only VW factory outside of China where workers don't belong to a union. India is raising tariffs on more than two dozen U.S. products. The tariffs that took effect yesterday include 70% levies on produce like apples, lentils, and almonds, along with a number of chemical products as well. India announced plans for those tariffs a year ago to retaliate against higher U.S. import duties on Indian steel and aluminum. They were delayed a number of times while India negotiated with U.S. trade officials. And the founders of Whataburger are selling a majority stake of their company. The Dobson family says Chicago-based BBT Capital Partners will buy most of the Texas company. Capital Partners will start expansion plans for Whataburger while keeping it headquartered in San Antonio. Whataburger also announced internal promotions, with CFO Ed Nelson becoming president, while VP of Business Operations Leonard Mazzocco will become COO. Current Whataburger CEO Preston Atkinson and board chair Tom Dobson will become board members, but step aside from the day-to-day operations. Whataburger has been around since 1950. Let's begin this morning with Americans living in two economies. New research suggests that may be the case and shows not everyone is doing well with their finances, and some are even worse off than before the Great Recession. Joining us this morning at Bankrate.com, senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick. Mark, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Always great to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
We want to talk this morning about some new research that's out, some new data. We're marking the anniversary of the Great Recession, and the survey says that there are a lot of folks that are worse off now than they were before the Great Recession. What's this research? What have you found?
Thanks, Steve. Well, it's important to me to try to underscore the varying experiences that Americans have all across this country, because as I've done this for a long time in terms of talking about the economy and personal finances, et cetera, one thing's been readily apparent to me, and that is that individuals, for example, hearing the daily headlines on the economy, have also varying responses to that news, because it doesn't always perfectly align with their own personal experience. And so you take something like the unemployment rate, which has been in the 3% range for off and on for some time now. Obviously, in varying communities, their results may vary. And so as we do mark the not only the 10-year anniversary of the expansion, but essentially the fact that once we get into July, the expansion will become a record in the sense of duration in U.S. history, we also kind of want to take a sense of where we are right now. And so it's quite dramatic, I think, that our survey finds that among adults who were in fact adults at the time that the recession began in 2007, roughly one quarter of them tell us that they are doing worse, and that includes about 25% of baby boomers, less so for members of the millennial generation. They would now be 29 to 38, again, because we're only sampling those that were adults when the problems began, and only 19% of the silent generation, 74 plus, and then across the spectrum, 25% say they're doing about the same, and then just a very slim majority, 51%, say they are doing better overall with their financial situation.
You know, I hear this too all the time, like you do. People say the economy is not working for them in some way or another. How do you explain that out? What would be behind that?
Well, first of all, you know, let's say that we take the most recent readings on growth in the United States, which on an annual basis, as you know, came in at about 3% for all of 2018 and just a little bit above 3% in the first quarter. And there are some reasons to, let's say, disparage the quality of that 3% in the first 3 months of the year, but that gets way off in the weeds. But we think about the fact that, and the survey demonstrates this, that if you think about, you know, if it's a graph or some other analogy where the financial crisis began and the recession began, essentially that graph starts heading lower. And so you're essentially digging a hole at that point, and we're getting in that hole. And then as the recession ends and essentially the expansion begins anew, you begin to try to climb out of the hole, but you may have wounds, you may have scars. And so I look at this as sort of an indication that many Americans still have wounds from that experience, and some have scars, and some have actually climbed out of the hole and are running away and seemingly relatively unscathed. So, for example, when we ask people about the negative impacts, 46% of homeowners said that their home lost value, and that makes sense because we know the housing market was ground zero for the crisis. 19% incurred substantial debt, probably because they lost income. 71% of investors said that they lost money. And I think this one is a pretty stunning statistic. 24% of those who had emergency savings said they completely depleted that account. And 21% of those with a working partner or spouse said that during the recession, one of them lost a job. So 54% in total suffered some negative impact at the time of the recession. And so, again, we're trying to heal those wounds, and some people are better healed than others.
Let's talk a little bit about the healing process. Time heals all wounds, they say. Is it just a matter of having more time for some of these folks to see improvement, or is it going to be a bigger solve than that?
Well, I've sometimes said that among the aspects of traditional common sense that I take issue with is the notion that that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger. I think sometimes that which doesn't kill us leaves us in critical condition. and you know, some people are still in critical condition from a financial or economic standpoint. But I think as we move forward, you know, for example, as we look at wage growth right now, which we've discussed many times has been one of the more subpar aspects of this economic expansion, so has growth compared to other expansions. You know, when we asked Americans about how their wages now compare to the time before the recession began, the majority told us their wages weren't any better. And so that gets back to the piece about income inequality. Some people are making more money. Some people are making substantially more money. And then there are some that feel like they're just sort of scraping to get by.
You know, a big chunk of the people who responded to this survey are baby boomers. For them, retirement's going to have to be on hold for a while, isn't it?
Well, yes, unfortunately. And you know, there would be different sort of flavors to that where they may try to continue to hold on to the work that they're currently doing. They may have to scale back their retirement plans instead of perhaps living where they currently live or moving off to, you know, sort of that traditional 1950s mentality of retirement where you're living on the golf course and living a life of leisure, which may or may not actually be ideal. And then, of course, there will be people who work, let's say, part-time rather than full-time. And we know that one of the unintended consequences of that has been then to reduce the employment opportunities for young people, particularly high school-aged Americans. And so, you know, I've talked a little bit recently about the fact that here we are at the summer job season. And when we look 40 years back, at that time, 1979, the majority of high school-aged Americans held a job. At least at some point during the year. And now that number is roughly one-third, those 16 to 19 years old. One of the reasons why they don't is, of course, many more stay in school more often or have more organized activities. Some are essentially, you know, being very, I'd say, aggressively managed by their parents in the time when some refer to that as sort of bulldozer parenting. That's another issue. But the other part of that is that sometimes some of these entry-level jobs are being held by elderly or more senior Americans because they need that to try to replenish the lost income that they suffered from the recession, et cetera.
Mark, there's also some insight here on gender inequality as well. The survey that we're talking about, women are especially having a hard time getting back to where they were pre-recession.
Yes, Steve, it's an important point, obviously, because for the fact that, you know, I think we're living in a time when there's an increased awareness of the inequality that women face on so many fronts. The Me Too movement, obviously, one demonstration of that, and hopefully we're getting to a better place, but just like all of these efforts, it seems like it takes a long time, longer than it should. One of the things, you know, people do tend to ask me, what's the most surprising thing about some of these surveys, and it usually takes a lot to surprise me because there is kind of a cadence of the information that presents itself over time that's not terribly dissimilar because we're always surveying at bank rate, as you know, and there are other surveys done by others, including the Federal Reserve, et cetera. But I think one of the most dramatic findings here is that women aren't faring as well as their male counterparts, and when you dive beneath the surface and the various metrics that we question, questions about here, whether it's wages, home values, debt, etc., women were trailing men on every category. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that, of course. It's complicated, but at the top of the list, obviously, the gender gap with respect to pay, the glass ceiling with respect to advancement, the fact that in the United States, we're the sole major industrialized democracy that lacks a federal mandate with respect to family leave. So women exit the workforce for a time. Very often they are the ones who shoulder the burden of raising children or caring for an elderly parent who may be ailing. And then it's harder for them to get back into the workforce. In the meantime, while they have essentially suspended their career, it's harder for them to recapture the pay that they either would have had or that they've lost. And so, this is very real. It doesn't really seem to capture a significant part of the conversation with respect to governance or the political debate in our country. And obviously, it's also a function of the private sector. So it's complicated, but it's real.
I know as most people are still that we're talking about are still struggling to catch up, but let's talk about some of the lessons that you learned from the Great Recession and how we apply those moving forward. Do the key pieces of advice stand here, and that is pay off debt and save for emergencies?
Yeah, this is one of the most important aspects, I think, Steve, because there's sort of the what did we learn from that piece, right? And so, as you know, at Bankrate, we're constantly trying to encourage people to make the right decisions as they try to improve their standing along their individual financial journey. And so we question people about how do they change their mindsets or their actions as a result of the recession. And we said that essentially they could tell us more than one, so there wasn't an only this aspect of the question or answering. But at the top of the list, 29% said they're more focused on paying down debt. And this is consistent with what we've seen elsewhere previously as well, that sort of the reduction in debt tends to be a top priority. Elsewhere, and I think this is also good news, a substantial number said that they were saving more for emergencies. They also told us that they're saving more for retirement. And 14% are still actively looking for a better job. That means probably that, in their view, either they lost ground or they still feel somewhat underemployed. 12% said they have a more affordable home or mortgage. And 10%, I thought this was interesting, 10% say they're investing less in stocks than they were before. So that may or may not be wise, because as we know, essentially being exposed to the market in one form or the other, mutual funds, exchange, traded funds, et cetera, this is the only way you're going to really get sufficient return on your money over time if you're looking out across a horizon of a decade or longer.
It's not hard to imagine that some of what we've been talking about here might be used in the political campaign that's starting to ramp up in the U.S. for president again. If we have a couple of different economies at work for the country, are the candidates going to use that in their stumps?
Well, I mean, I think the issues, whether they use the bank rate debt or not, is another question. There's, it's a free country and the information is credible. But I think that this is, to the extent that, as a country, I think we want to succeed collectively. And even though these days it's a very kind of a vicious, noisy, almost toxic environment politically, my sense is that it's exactly these kinds of problems that have led us to this situation, as opposed to, let's say, the post-World War II experience, where there was a sense that many Americans were participating in the lifting of the economic plight of the country. We know that, of course, sexism and racism were rampant back in those days. That tends to be reduced in the collective memory of the country and in the cause of patriotism and all those other things. But to the extent that some Americans seem to be struggling mightily these days, whether it's in some of the smaller communities of the country or even a particular neighborhood, I think that some people do look to the government to try to foster some sorts of either responses or solutions to that, and I think that's an appropriate conversation to have. What exactly the solutions or answers should be, obviously it's a decision to be made by the electorate and by the elected officials, although you have to say in recent times the elected officials, at least at the federal level, haven't exactly been on the case with delivering solutions that the people need.
Mark, thank you for sharing the data and your analysis as well. We appreciate it.
Great pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
Mark Hamrick, Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. We're going to continue our conversation with Mark after the bell this morning and post more of our conversation, some good financial planning information, some good data on how people are recovering from the Great Recession in the podcast of the opening bell a little bit later this morning at WGNRadio.com. Of course, you can also find more over at Bankrate.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition of The Opening Bell. Burger King has the Impossible Whopper. Now, everyone wants to know when and if McDonald's will add a plant-based burger in the U.S. to its menu. Joining us this morning is Jonathan Mays, executive editor at Restaurant Business Magazine. Jonathan, good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Interesting conversation here. I think Burger King is still in the testing phase of the Impossible Whopper, but I guess it is a valid question. Is McDonald's even thinking about this?
Oh, I think they're thinking about it, and they're paying an awful lot of attention to it. They have a vegan burger in Germany, for instance, and it's something they're paying very close attention to because it's a pretty big trend suddenly right now in the quick service space.
Yeah, it's interesting. In reading your story at Restaurant Business Online, McDonald's has a few interesting little ties here to the plant-based world, mm-hmm. doesn't it?
Nestle provides its vegan burger in Germany, and Nestle is going big into this market in Europe. It is planning to add a plant-based product in the United States. Tyson, which last week revealed its entrance into this market, it is a very big McDonald's supplier. So yeah, they do have a couple of ties to larger companies that are making moves into the plant-based market right now.
You mentioned Beyond Meat earlier. A former McDonald's CEO, Don Thompson, is a board member there. So that's kind of another little connection. So what will be the deciding factor here, Jonathan? Is it just a sales-based thing, or are they going to see how well this popularity plays out in the next months or even longer?
Yeah, they are taking a wait-and-see approach, I think, on this one. They're content with letting Burger King and White Castle and Carl's Jr. and some others sort of test the market and see whether this is going to be able to sustain. I think they're concerned that it's going to be a fad and that this is like something that just gets really hot for a moment and then sort of dies down after a while, which can frequently happen. And so they're perfectly content with letting other people sort of test this at the moment.
Give us a sense of what the McDonald's would have to do to get some of these burgers in its locations. Is there something that would have to happen different with the chain that goes to putting a burger out onto the counter?
Well, if McDonald's is going to do something like this, first off, there has to be enough supply out there. And right now we see some, Impossible Foods has some real supply constraints at the moment. They don't have the manufacturing capacity to meet all of the demand. And McDonald's is a much, much bigger player. So first off, there has to be manufacturing capacity because McDonald's is much larger than Burger King or anybody else out there. And then if they're going to do this, and the reason why they want to make sure this is a longer term trend and not a fad is because they have to, for instance, devote some grill space. So in McDonald's restaurants, which are very busy, if they're going to start making a vegetarian burger, they would have to devote a certain portion of their grill space to this particular product. And that would take some space, from something else. And so that's not as, it's not as easy for McDonald's, which does a lot more business than a typical Burger King or a typical White Castle. And then the other issue that they're concerned with is simplification. So it's a very, very, McDonald's already has a very broad menu. They're concerned about speed, and McDonald's has been slowing down a lot. They're not as fast as they really want to be. And so they're reducing items from their menu at the moment. And they want to, so if they're going to add something like this, they're going to have to take something off the menu or something along those lines.
Yeah, and as you write, it wouldn't be the first time that something that's come on really strong has kind of fizzled out. And you write about over at Burger King, one of their, I think it was a special French fry that they added to its menu. It was only on the menu for about a year, and then customers kind of got tired of it, right?
Right, that was Satisfries. So they had done a lot of work and introduced this this sort of a healthier version of a French fry called Satisfries. They got a lot of, you know, they did what Burger King tends to do, is they got a lot of attention for it. Did a lot of did a lot of viral media marketing, and then sales were really strong for a bit, and then it just sort of fizzled out because people just sort of went back to their habits.
You know, another issue too is the price. What would a price point for a plant-based burger likely be at McDonald's, and how would that impact customers?
That's a really good question, and you know, I'm not sure. I mean, it probably would cost about $6 for a plant-based burger at McDonald's. I think based on what we've seen at other concepts, and yeah, that's expensive for a McDonald's burger. You know, and that's already, you know, it's competing already with fast casual burger players, and do you really want to spend, how much money do you really want to spend on a burger at McDonald's? And I think that's a really big open question. It's already an issue, I think, at many of their restaurants, because a lot of their premium burgers are over $5, a pop. And I think Big Mac is really expensive. And at some point, people don't really want to spend a lot of money at McDonald's. You go there because the food, because you want something fast, you want it cheap, and you know what you're going to get. And you want to get on your way. You don't want to, if you're going to spend, at some point, if you're going to spend a certain amount of money, you're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I think that gets expensive.
Right, and you back to the menu items. I know at my McDonald's, they've cleaned the menu off clean. There's a it's been streamlined recently. I mean, some of those signature sandwiches are gone. I know their foray into bacon with different things has been gone. At least at my McDonald's, it is. So that's another issue too. I mean, you kind of want to have breakfast is the star at McDonald's. Do they have room for another star? I guess is the better question.
Well, that is a really good question, and I think I think at this particular point, McDonald's really is trying to sort of streamline their menu a little bit, and you know, if they're going to add something, I probably would like to see them take something away if it's going to be a permanent menu item, because it's really complicated for the franchisees to operate at this particular point, and that's slowing things down. I mean, right now, you're right, they're reducing items. They're actually reducing the size of their all-day breakfast menu, for instance. So, I mean, you could potentially see something, maybe some room that way for them to add something like this over time. But I think from their standpoint, I think they'd like to see this be a longer-term trend before they really go into it.
Before we let you go this morning, Jonathan, I wanted to get your impressions on this story. I know you saw it, the drone deliveries of McDonald's testing in San Diego. Talk to us a little bit about that, and are we going to see that in Chicago anytime soon?
I don't know that I would hold your breath at seeing something like that in Chicago anytime soon. I think it is something they have, they are definitely interested in. They really do believe that delivery is a big trend, and they're going big into it. And so this is one of those, this is something that they're definitely willing to test to see how this thing works. I still think we're a ways off to seeing broad drone delivery of restaurant food. I think there are a lot of, there are a lot of sort of things that they have to work out logistically for this thing to work. And, It's fascinating that we're going to start seeing, something like this happen at a concept like McDonald's, and it's the restaurant chain that you could see where drone deliveries could actually potentially work on a broad scale, because there's so many of them and the drones don't have to travel that far. So, we'll see. I wouldn't hold my breath on it anytime soon, though.
Jonathan, thank you for being with us this morning. We appreciate your insight and analysis on all of this.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Mays, executive editor over at Restaurant Business Magazine. We're going to link out to his latest story on this as well. You can find more at restaurantbusinessonline.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, we're losing a little steam in the futures market this morning as we head to The Opening Bell. Dow futures now up just a fraction. NASDAQ and S&P futures also each up fractionally this morning heading to The Opening Bell. We had been up a little bit more earlier this morning, but again, the trend downward this morning heading to 8:30 Chicago time. Now let's get an update on agriculture and commodities. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. The question for grain traders this morning and this week, can they maintain the strength of last week? Because we ended the day Friday with July corn up 11¼ cents a bushel, July soybeans up 9¼ cents, and July wheat ended Friday up 4 cents a bushel. On the other hand, livestock futures need some of that grain strength because August hogs were down $2.77, August cattle down 32 cents, and August feeder cattle down 85 cents a hundredweight. And we'll wait for the afternoon report on crop conditions and planting progress. Rain in some parts of the Corn Belt, but other parts fairly dry and able to get planting taken care of. As we ended the week last Friday, two Midwest senators said they have introduced a bill to reform the EPA's biofuel waiver program, which the corn industry says helps big oil at the expense of farmers by threatening ethanol demand. The bill was introduced by Republican Deb Fisher of Nebraska and Democrat Tammy Duckworth of Illinois. It would impose a June 1st deadline for refineries to apply for the waivers that exempt them from having to blend ethanol into gasoline. We'll see where, if anywhere, that legislation goes. And Purdue Foods, one of America's largest chicken producers, said it will sell frozen chicken nuggets mixed with cauliflower, chickpeas, and plant protein to address the growing demand for products combining meat and vegetables. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. Before we leave you, just a couple of more headlines here. The chief executive of Boeing says the company made a mistake in handling a problematic cockpit warning system in its 737 MAX jets before two crashes killed 346 people. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg promising transparency as the aircraft maker works to get the grounded plane back in flight. Federal Aviation Administration has faulted Boeing for not telling regulators more than a year that a safety indicator in the cockpit of the top-selling plane didn't work as intended. And Airbus will start making a new single-aisle long-range jet, beating rival Boeing to the market in that category. The European plane maker launched the A321XLR jet today at the Paris Air Show, saying it'll be ready for customers in 2023 and fly up to 4,700 miles. Boeing says the jet is an upgraded version of the existing A321 and will cost significantly less than building an entirely new aircraft. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Monday, June the 17th. The National Association of Home Builders Housing Market Index for June is due out. Housing industry analysts see the index softening slightly after hitting a seven-month high in May. Also today, the Empire State Manufacturing Survey. We'll also get a report on U.S. Treasury foreign ownership. And as we mentioned, the Paris Air Show getting underway. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday, June the 17th.